Hello, and welcome to the April 16, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new, if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or estate of any performer or composer dead and gone, to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is New York City-based jazz vocalist Nama. Inspired by the emotionally direct compositions of Rodgers and Hart, Fields and Hough, Cole Porter, and other great composers and lyricists of the 1930s and 1940s, Nama has established herself as a prominent voice in the New York City jazz scene. Possessed with an urbane and elegant sound, Nama's sensitive interpretation and crisp phrasing have become recognizable elements of her signature style and timeless appeal. An honest and poignant performer, Nama has appeared in celebrated festivals and acclaimed jazz venues domestically and internationally. Nama's newest album, currently slated for a June release, is entitled Wild Is Love on La Reserve Records. With Peter Bernstein on guitar, Glenn Zaleski on piano, Dave Barron on bass, and Charles Gould on drums. She also has a new single from the album, released on April 5th, 2024, entitled I'm Glad There Is You. Nama was born in 1991 to aspiring scientist Ambera Shiva, a southern city in the Negev Desert of Israel. When she was 4 years old, the family relocated to Baltimore, Maryland for a period of 4 years. When I think of it, that was where my infatuation with American culture and music was first formed, she recalls. Her parents thought it best for her to study piano. That was where music first entered my life, but after 10 years of classical piano, I realized that I actually wanted to sing. In spite of her wish, Nama wasn't encouraged to pursue singing right away. To this day, my father will tell you I couldn't carry a note until a late age. When I asked for singing lessons, my parents offered drama classes instead. It was not until her senior year in high school when she decided to study voice professionally. I used my grandparents' graduation gift to pay for lessons with the famous Israeli singer Ricky Gall. It was such a big deal for me, a young girl from the South, taking weekly trips to Tel Aviv to study with a master. I can recall the day she said, "You know, you should really be singing jazz." In 2012, Nama was accepted to the Center for Jazz Studies in Tel Aviv, where she spent 3 years studying jazz and classical voice. Exposed to new music, She was infatuated by singers like Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, and Frank Sinatra. I was seduced by the urbane lyrical style along with the beautifully constructed melodies these singers were singing. I immediately felt at home with these songs. I worked on finding my own voice within these standards and found ways to insert fresh concepts to make them interesting. In 2015, Nama's ticket to New York City came in the form of a scholarship to attend the prestigious jazz program at the New School for Performing Arts. Soon after, she began performing throughout the city and gaining experience as well as respect from soon-to-be fans and colleagues. Throughout her time in New York City, Nama has shared the stage with celebrated jazz musicians such as Steve Nelson, Dave Kokoski, Bruce Barth, Michael Kanin, David Wong, Ray Gallen, Carlos Abadi, Neil Minor, and appears regularly in some of New York City's major jazz venues, Birdland, Smalls, a weekly residence at Mesro, the Django, and others. When she isn't singing, Nama spends her time teaching aspiring vocalists as well as instrumentalists in her home studio in the Chelsea neighborhood. Nama emphasizes healthy, natural singing. Her approach combines speech therapy and classical singing techniques. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Nama. Hello, Nama.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, it's going pretty well, thank you. It's really wonderful to have you on my show. It's great to talk with you, and I'm excited to learn more about you and about your music and have my audience do the same. You know, I would like to get right to it. Let's strike while the iron's hot and get to the new album that you are currently producing and set to release in June, if I remember correctly.
Yes, that's correct. June 28th,
an album entitled Wild is Love. And and you've also got some other singles that you're releasing along the way that are from the album. So would you please talk to us about the music on this album? Everything from concept to how you chose the songs you chose to production, what happened in the studio, any kinds of interesting anecdotes you could share with us to help us understand and appreciate your work further.
Yes, well, I'm really happy to be here, first of all, so thanks for having me. I have been attempting this thing in the past few years where I release a recording once a year in the hopes that it helps me, you know, grow as an artist and also allows me to reach new fans. When you do it a lot, you know, the first maybe two, you're like, oh, I really want to record this song and this song, or you know, you have like an idea, but then at some point it becomes, you know, you have to kind of do a more thorough job in thinking about what it is that you really want to present and what's the story that you want to tell. And when I was brainstorming for Wild is Love, I really enjoy telling stories, and I really like in this whole like jazz singer world that I live in, my ultimate goal and where I feel best is on stage with an audience that is connected to what I'm singing. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's like this magical thing that happens. It doesn't happen all the time and not on every show, but there are these moments that are just priceless. I can't achieve them in any other aspect of my life except for that. And I realized that to achieve that, I really need to be feeling what I am singing about. Honesty, vulnerability is something that I really, it's not easy to achieve all the time, especially not in a live performance, but when it is achieved and the audience perceives it, I feel like something amazing happens. And so when I choose my recording studio materials, I always have this kind of situation in mind where I want to be, you know, putting out music that people listen and feel something, but I also want to be on stage singing it to them and experiencing, you know, what they give back to me and what we kind of create together as like humans in this, you know, sacred space of, you know, musical show. And so my what I wanted to choose to like, you know, sing about in this album had to be something that I felt connected to and I felt like was human and real and, you know, a little bit of a theme, but not for it to be a theme, but because it's a story that I connect to. So I thought, what is more relatable than like a love story in all its phases? Regardless of who I was singing to, they must have had a crush or a, you know, love that they really wanted to happen and they weren't sure that it would. They must have had this, I hope for everybody, a moment in their life where they felt like completely, you know, pure bliss and like so in love with a person, very grateful. And unfortunately, most of us also experienced heartbreak and you know, stuff that didn't necessarily work out. So I thought it would be really nice to choose songs that I love, you know, from the Great American Songbook for the most part, that kind of reflect each one of these. I called it like three or four phases, the phase of falling in love or having a crush on somebody and, you know, the back and forth in one's mind about, am I dreaming? Is this real? Does this person like me? Will they like me if I tell them? To, oh, this person likes me. I can't believe it. I'm the most, you know, luckiest person in the world because I have it. Like they love me, you know, to having an amazing partner and, you know, growing together as a couple. And then we have that was the second phase. The third one would be like, you know, where things kind of start to be not as easy as you thought at the beginning, and some heartbreak, some sad songs that what to do, there are always the best. And then so that's like the third phase of the album. And the last song is called Wild as Love, which is also the title track. It's kind of just basically talks about the fact that love is kind of like why we are here on this planet. It's in everything we do. And even though it is painful and wild, we can't really do without it. And it's kind of part of
Sure.
our humanity. So that was the concept of the album. Sorry, that was a long answer, I feel like.
No, that's okay. That's what I want. I want some in-depth kind
Okay,
of
great.
thinking and understanding because I love intelligent musical talk, you know, when we really look at why
Awesome.
we do what we do, you know, kind of engaging in that what we call metacognition, thinking why we're thinking what we're thinking. And
Totally.
so that's fine. You keep right on going. You're doing great.
Perfect. Great. So yeah, so that was the concept. And then came the song selection, band selection. Like I said, because I have a live show in mind when I record, I do think of, you know, a way to make it interesting for the listener. So I played around with the band that I have. It features Peter Bernstein on guitar, which was a huge honor to finally be able to record with him. And on piano we have Glenn Zaleski, who's an amazing pianist. Dave Barron, who I know you've spoken to before, also my partner in real life, and also a long time. He's been in my band for around 8.5 years now. So he's plays bass and also arranged and helped me kind of craft this whole project.
Wonderful.
And Charles Gould is on drums, and we have different settings of the band in every song. Some songs have all the musicians in, and some are smaller variations of the band. And then in the studio, we also another thing I've been doing because nowadays we have it's all about, you know, media and what you a visual presence. So we also did video recordings of the live session in the studio, which turned out amazing. There's this great videographer named Dasha there who did this did like six beautiful videos, which is an amazing thing, but also I have to say adds another level of complexity to the recording session, because I change clothes every time. it's different when you recording in a set scenario where you are being videoed as well. So it was, of course, as always, challenging, and like feels like a crazy, a crazy day.
Sure.
But yeah, I think I'm happy with the result, and
Well,
I hope people will be too.
I think you should be. I think you should be. I mean, I've listened to
Thank you.
the entire album. I love it. And I'm going to let you on a little secret when you talk. I maybe the one of the reasons that I love If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight is you sell that song so well. All I can think of
Thank
is
you.
Nama loves me.
Yes, great. Thank you.
And I say that sort of in a tongue in cheek, because you're in a relationship and I'm a happily married man.
Oh, I
But
know, I
just
know.
for those 4 minutes, for
That's
those
okay.
4 minutes, that song, I think, yeah, Nama
That's
has a
it.
crush on me. I just because you
But that's
sell,
exactly it.
yeah. Well, I mean, you sell it so well. I think that that's it.
Thank you.
Hey, and I've talked to Dave, and he's a great guy. Would it be fair to say he was sort of a ghostwriter for you on this recording? You said he had some input and some work with it.
Yes, he totally, we totally worked together on the arrangements,
Wonderful,
and
wonderful.
he some of them he wrote, like, yes, it was different levels of collaboration with him, but yeah, he's been, it's really nice to have a rhythm section member who's also an amazing bass player
Yes.
in your band, who also happens to be, my partner. So
Yeah, who
it's
stores his bass right there behind you. So, yeah.
yeah, you can see it right here. Didn't even, yeah.
Yeah, I know it's wonderful.
Didn't even plan
It's
it.
wonderful being in a relationship with another musician. I know I'm lucky. My wife is also a pianist and a vocalist, and she also plays harp
Oh,
and
that's amazing.
recorder.
Oh, that's
And
great.
so I think when you're in a relationship with another musician, they kind of understand, you understand each other's sort of weird little proclivities that perhaps a musical layperson may not.
It's so true. Sometimes people
Yeah.
ask me, like, because I've only my all of my relationships have been with musicians.
Yeah.
And sometimes people ask me, like, why are you always with people like from your don't aren't you isn't it like complicated like to work together? And I'm like, first of all, both my parents are scientists in a very close field, so like I grew up with that
Yeah.
thing with work
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
personal being very involved. So to me,
Yeah.
it's very normal. But I also, like you said, I can't imagine a situation where this whole huge part of me, which basically defines me or defines a very big part of me, is like foreign to, and I'm sure people, I know people make it work, but to
Oh,
me,
yeah.
like it's really amazing to have that, with, the personal stuff that have nothing to do with music too.
Well, musicians, we have, part of us, I think, are a little bit insane because we've spent so much time alone, honing the craft on our instrument. It's almost like we become
Right.
hermits, and then we go out and we interact with people. And but I can
Yeah.
often think
True.
about friends of mine I had. What do you mean you got to go practice for an hour? I said, yeah. I says, I'm kind of committed to this. And it's nice, like my wife, we were both are musicians. We were both also educators in higher education. So we had a lot in common, but we always brought our work home with us. So there's an upside
Yeah.
downside, but anyway, well, that's
Totally.
great. And give my best to Dave when you see him next, because
I will. I
he was a
will.
great
Yes.
guest, and of course he introduced me to you. So I'm really happy for that as well.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back for a moment to what I've already told you is my personal favorite song on the album, is that 1926 classic by James P. Johnson, who was a great songwriter and stride pianist. If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight, what drew you to this song? And how were some of the decisions made about how to do the song and make it yours?
So I actually knew I've known the song for a very long time.
Okay.
The reason was when I started singing, basically, when I entered my the first program that I sang in Israel. I'm from Israel. I was chosen to be one of the vocalists, featured vocalists in the big band of the school. And one of the arrangements that they did for vocalists was the Count Basie version of the song with Helen Humes, a very young Helen Humes. And I learned it then, so it was one of the first things I practiced, and wanted to really be good at. And then years later, I kind of forgot about it, but it was always in the back of my mind. I was reminded of it every once in a while, and I was like, wow, I love this song so much. And then when came time, I actually was, this was not one of the first ones I thought about, because I actually was looking for like a tune that was swinging enough to be like a first song of of the album, but that also talked about longing to be with someone, but not necessarily being with someone yet. Because I had the other ones, like I sing I Got It Bad Over There and like Who Am I, which are very more involved, kind of like heavier tunes, but I needed something that was, and it was really hard to think of one actually. And then this song came to mind, and I was like, wow, this is perfect for my narrative and a great first song. And because I think I learned it from an old recording, I had this vision of sound a little, like you said, like a little bit New Orleansy kind of maybe 1920s, 30s kind of vibe. Also, honestly, my first vision of this album had a trumpet or like a horn as well, which ended up not happening because of logistical financial reasons. So in my head, I envisioned like a trumpet with a mute maybe playing the first like chorus, the first like the head end or something. Yeah, so maybe that's why you like it so much.
Well, maybe I think now that you've talked about it, I mean, the Basie, he learned, he was from Red Bank, New Jersey, but so was Fats Waller, and Fats Waller, of course, was a wonderful stride player as well as a singer and entertainer. I mean, there's a Fats Waller song I love to do called "I'm Going to Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter."
A letter, I know,
Yeah,
yeah.
I love that
Really hard.
song. But it has that wonderful kind of almost two beat feel that's transitioning into swing, that very late 20s, early 30s kind of sound. And then the drummer, with
Charles,
that, Charles, thank you. Charles, with the using the press rolls, I thought, this is cool. This is like,
Isn't
this
it?
could
Yeah.
be a New Orleans, kind of a sound,
Totally.
so I really kind of really dug that, but it is clearly my
Yeah.
favorite. But I love the fact that you open it, because now I think about why you like this song and why I like it, because it's a little bit of a tease.
It is.
If I could only be with you for 1 hour tonight, the things I'd do to you, and so on.
Yeah,
And
there's a right.
I mean, that whole line, it's really kind of a tease, but
It is, it's
clearly
true.
my favorite. But I've got another one I want to ask you about, because this one completely blew me out of the water because of my unawareness. And that was "The Moon Is Gone." I never knew that there were lyrics
Oh,
put to Isfahan.
well, I wrote to them. That's why.
You wrote the lyrics.
Those are original lyrics of mine,
Huh, isn't that cool? That is
yeah.
so
I
cool.
thank you. Yeah, those are, that's the one original like part of like the rest are all have all been composed and written by others, but this one was the lyrics are mine
Wow.
for the song.
And
Yeah.
I love like the way you do, like everything just comes to a stop and then you come back in, and it reminded me
That
so
comfort.
much of the last time I heard Joe Henderson live.
That's
He came to Milwaukee, and he had a drummer and a bass player backing him up. And I remember this was right after he released a recording of all Ellington and Strayhorn tunes. And I remember he played Isfahan, and just the way he did that, and that moment of hesitation when there's that silence, and then it pulls you right, surprises you right back in. And you kind of do that as well, and I love that.
It's funny that you mentioned it because I mean I did I always I like I said I think about variety and I was like what song would be cool with a bass only And I was listening to all kinds of stuff. And then I came across like the Joe Henderson version, which is only him and bass.
Yeah.
And I was like, because again, like especially for that part of the album where it's songs about breakups, there are millions of ballads that I would love to sing. But I was looking for stuff that would fit this arc, but not wouldn't all be sad ballads at the end, because I don't know. I was like, I'm thinking about it. I'm a listener listening to like my album, and then from song like 8 to 10 to like 11, he's just like, so sad because it's like ballad after ballad. So I figured, yeah. And then I heard the Joe Henderson op like where he just does it like kind of not super slow and with a bass only, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna do that. Which ended up being a very hard thing to do because it's not a super easy melody to sing with only bass.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got as I haven't analyzed what that opening of beep-a-doo-doo, those opening four or five notes are, what chord that is. But yeah, I've got an arrangement that I've written for one of my bands that features my tenor player and Sean. And I call it Sean's Trip to Isfahan. And
Sean, oh, nice.
It's hard even on an instrument, not as hard as voice, but to get that and get it to come out exactly right. So I imagine that was a good challenge. You probably had to do a little bit of ear training to
For
nail
both of
it.
us, but Dave and I worked on it. We had to work on it. I was actually, I'm still to this day, like when I perform it, it's still the scariest song that I have to say.
I
Also,
wouldn't
it's like
doubt
my
it.
lyrics too, so I'm still,
Okay. All right. All right.
new to the whole like singing my original stuff on stage because I usually do standard, so.
Oh yeah, sure. But something like I mean, it's just kind of out in left field. I mean, like I said, until now, I never, well, of course, there were never any lyrics to the song because you wrote them. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see if any others pick up on that idea or choose to record your version. That's really cool. That's
Oh,
really
yeah, I didn't
cool.
even think about that. That's a thing, I guess, when you write your own thing. We'll see.
Well, I think, it's like
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I get a lot of my arranging ideas from listening to other people's music. And I'll think, oh, that's a cool idea. I'm going to go with that, but I'm going to apply it to this
On
too.
something, yeah. Totally.
Because there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, we beg, steal, borrow from the best and come up with something new. But
Always.
I think that's very cool. All right. Well, that's
Always.
great. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the recording that I haven't asked you, we haven't talked about? I just want to make sure we don't leave this in the dust because it's a wonderful album.
No, I think I said a lot about it. Yeah, and like you said, it's coming out in June, but there have been singles rolling out. We're releasing one
Okay.
every 6 weeks, so the next one's coming out on Friday. That one's a duet with Peter, called "I'm Glad There Is You," which is, I think, a beautiful ballad.
Yes,
Yeah, but
it
that's it.
is.
Yes.
Yes, it is. Oh, wonderful. Well,
Thanks
that's
for talking
great.
about it.
Oh, that's all
Thank
right.
you.
We want to make sure people are up and aware of what's going on out there because there's a lot of great music floating around this world that I think too many people don't know about or don't know enough
Agreed.
about. So that's kind of my raison d'être for my podcast. Is to get people
Amazing.
aware of things. So good. All right. Well,
Amazing.
I in addition to fronting your own projects, do you do any other gigs or recordings as side projects with other musicians?
Not a bunch, but I do. Sing with the George G Big Band here in New York. He's been
Huh.
around for quite a while. I think I want to say 30 years, but even maybe more possibly. So I sing. I do like featured vocalists with the big band sometimes. And here and there, just mostly projects I get called for either performing or studio, but it varies. It's not any no regular one.
Yeah, it's kind of catch as catch can anyway, but some commercial work and so forth. Okay. Well, that's always good to know. You brought up singing with a big band. What sort of shift, if you will, or what do you use a different set of muscles, and I mean that metaphorically, when you sing with a big band versus a combo?
Yes, I was just literally talking about that yesterday, because I was doing the gig. Yeah, it's actually one of the reason why I do is because it's I feel like technically it, as a vocalist who uses a mic nowadays, there aren't all like a bunch of opportunities to have need to project in the way that you need to do with a big band, in a healthy way without, you know, damaging my vocal folds. So yeah, I definitely need to you know, input a lot more support and involve more of my long ago classical singing technique to figure out how to do it so that it comes out well, but also, you know, is healthy.
I remember I interviewed another singer in New York, from New York. Oh, it's been several months ago, who did also combos and big bands, and I asked her what the biggest challenge was in singing with a big band, and she says remembering the roadmap of the arrangement.
That is so true. Totally.
You know, because
Yes.
some arrangers do some pretty wild things, you know, like instead of just following, you know, the form, it's like, well, let's bring it back in at the bridge, or let's, you know, that sort of thing. So,
That's so true. And I
yeah.
mean, as when you're a vocalist, when you're a jazz singer, a lot of times, you know, I control that on my gigs. So if I decide, you know, if I forget to come in or whatever, it's okay, or you guys play another chorus. But yeah, it's a very big shift to do that with other people's music and arrangements. And I don't like to sing with lyrics and music in front of me, because I feel like it's, you know, it comes between me and the audience. So I really need to know it by heart. Otherwise,
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I'm always just curious to know how different people respond in different situations. So let's talk about your song choice. And I'm talking about not just on the latest album, but overall in your recorded output. That's all I can speak to because I haven't had the wonderful opportunity to hear you live yet. Someday I may
must
show
change
up.
that.
Yes, we must. I have to get to
Yes,
New
please.
York. I keep talking to my wife about, you know, some autumn in New York. We need to be there, you know,
Yes,
and
definitely the
get
best
hit,
time.
you know, and hit some clubs. But anyway, I think it's fair
Yes.
to say that standards comprise a good deal of your repertoire, if not much of
All
your
of it.
repertoire.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, what is it about a particular song that draws you to want to perform it or record it?
Okay. If I had it my way, all I would be doing is heartfelt ballads. I mean, it like I mean, again, like I love the slow emotional ballads. That's like I'm a sucker for them. Maybe like one day when I'm old and famous, I'll do like a billion ballad albums. So but yes, I mean, I'm definitely drawn to lyrics. Yes, the melodies, of course, but like somehow with the if the story, if the melody is beautiful and the story is like something I really can't connect to, it's hard for me to sing it unless I find a way to like make it mine. So I would say the first thing would be that, like the story, the lyrics. That being said, I love singing, you know, up tempo stuff, swinging things. So I guess I on the ones on the songs that are a little more you know, that aren't heartfelt ballads, I am very drawn, I think, to how much you can swing it. A lot of times that's influenced by recordings that I hear, to be honest. I think if I happen to hear a song that I like, because I don't know, I'll listen to it, to Carmen McRae sing it, and I just can't stop listening to how she phrases and swings the song, then I might, you know, I'll probably decide to to like adopt it and make it my own. So I would say like, yeah, I would say that usually I'm just influenced by recordings that I hear of people. And so, actually, like in New York, I go out and hear a lot of try to go listen to a lot of singers, and I have heard some really beautiful music that I hadn't heard before on shows, and then kind of made a note on it during the show, and then went home and learned it. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question. There's
Well, it
a
does. I
lot of
mean, I
things.
no, I think it's a very straightforward, honest question. And I think there's a lot to that. It was often said about, or I've heard it said, I don't know how often it was said, but that Frank Sinatra transformed over to be a good actor. Simply because when he sang a song, he treated every song like the lyrics were a script, and that
Yeah.
he was very much into telling stories. And
Right.
and so when you'd hear Sinatra deliver a song, it's like he's telling this story, albeit in a very short, 3.5 minutes maybe less. But it's still a story nonetheless. And I used to use the same kind of comparison when I taught German Lieder in my music appreciation class. I'd say, well, if we look at this lead, excuse me, by Schubert, and I would like Die Erlkönig, for example. And I say, okay, in this short little poem, this is telling a complete story. It creates a scene, it creates a mood, it creates atmosphere, and it comes to a conclusion. And it's poetry is like that, because obviously he was just using Goethe's poem and setting it to music, but enhancing the text through the musical choices that he made. So I think that beautiful standard songs, I often, like when I go to my health club, and of course they've got music playing on the sound system in the locker room, and people know that I'm a former music professor, and so I'll very often get asked the question, "Hey doc, what is that?" And I says, "Well, I don't know, but it isn't Nat King Cole singing 'My Sweet Lorraine,' I mean, there's certain songs that I have to have, that I love lyrics that have some depth, that have some meaning, or that create
Me
some
too.
wonderful imagery. I think those are important kinds of things, and we have that
I agree.
with different. And I love the fact too, I think that standards can, you can really massage the way they're done. That's why they're
Yeah.
great works of art, because
Very true.
about 2 3 weeks ago, actually, the episode with her interview goes live tomorrow with a singer out of Minneapolis. Her name's Leslie Vincent, and she has a new recording out. She does a version of Black Coffee, which, when it was done by Ella, when it was done by Sarah Vaughan, everybody else, always a real down tempo torch song, bluesy kind of ballad, and she does it more as an up tempo piece. And I asked her about that. She said, well, it wasn't just to do it differently, but she was trying to convey perhaps a different mood, and so forth. And I thought, it's a very appropriate kind of way to do things. But anyway.
Yeah, I feel no, you're right, and I feel like what you touched on is really, it's true, because like these songs have been done and recorded so many times. If we're choosing something like Black Coffee or something that is a very popular jazz standard. And then there's always the kind of this balance between you want to make it different, but to make it different just to make it different, usually, I don't know, it doesn't work because it's not really honest. It comes out as like overdone. So it's a really important point there where it's like on one hand you want to rent, you want to be new, you want to do something that's new, but you got to find how the balance and making it like real and true to you and honest so that people will believe it.
Otherwise it comes across as contrived, kind of like, oh, I see, you're just trying to make this do this different or do it weird,
We call it jazz cool,
Jazz
many
what?
hits, jazz cool like hits, and like uneven meters and all these like why did you do that though? Is there a reason behind it, or are you just trying to make it cool because
Well, and I think
it's
too, there's a lot of room and a lot of fun that can be had by taking a familiar song and deconstructing it, and
not?
just kind of like melting it down to its bare essence, and then kind of building it back up. And I'll give you a real quick example. I have one of my groups is kind of a mini New Orleans brass band. It's again a three-piece. It's tuba, trombone, and trumpet. One of the tunes that we like to play is Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. And so usually when we play it, I've told the other two guys in my group, I said, now basically, there's three basic pieces of musical information that we can play with. There's the bass line, there's the refrain, and then there's whatever we choose to improvise over the chord change. And I don't care what order you do them in, but those are just the kinds of things that you can draw from that still retains the essence of the song, but allows us to deconstruct it and then build something completely new. And actually, I
Very
learned
cool.
that from a bass player named Peter Brendler, who I had on the show. Oh, it's probably been over a year ago. And on one of his albums, he has a version of Walk on the Wild Side, which it then
Interesting.
inspired me to do it. But I think too, with
Nice.
standards, I think there's a lot of things you can bring to life. What are some of the things that you maybe focus on that you can take with a standard that will make it unique to you?
Good question. I guess, I mean, I feel like I keep saying the lyrics, but I also teach this. I think phrasing and phrasing, but in a way that like services the song and the story, is a very important thing for a jazz singer. It's also unique because, I mean, not that instrumentalists can't phrase, but we actually have the words. And one of the exercises that I learned from an amazing vocalist named Yala Balin, who was my teacher years ago, and now we're great friends, and that I now like also teach my students, is to really go basically like sentence by sentence and choose a lyric that is, that you place a higher value in the sentence than the others, and if that's personal, it could be different ones. And you choose to emphasize that one in the phrasing, in a way that you choose. It can be like a pitch, or it could be rhythmically, or how long or how short you choose to sing that lyric. And that creates a very like a unique, but also once you like learn how to do it, and like jazz and language and harmony and stuff, you can make it super swinging, very like something you've heard before, but also new and yours, because it's about what lyrics spoke to you, like in that moment when you chose it. So that's a way that I would do that, and then you get like this result that sounds different than other recordings. I do like to play with tempos. I try to not overdo it, but like if the song calls for it, then making parts of it faster, or like going double time, or slowing it down to half time, or rubato. Like one of the things I like, and I should do more, is like how playing a bridge rubato all of a sudden, which is also surprising to the listener, and could work if the lyrics call for it, if the story calls for it. And then there's the arrangement part, which I've been trying more and more to, kind of like what you said about Black Coffee, figure out a way to make an intro that speaks to what I'm trying to convey in that in the song. Yeah.
Yeah,
So
that's
those
good. Kind
are
of like taking, it's like making something new out of something old. And you keep the best
Exactly.
spots, you highlight the certain things that are important and change things around. Well, that's a good way to answer that, I think. I would tell my when I used to teach jazz history, I would, I'd talk a lot about why Billie Holiday was such a great jazz singer. It wasn't because she had such a great instrument. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't it she didn't have a lot of range and she so forth. But
Totally.
it was her phrasing. It was her phrasing that really did it. And I said, it's sort of like if I hand you a script and you read it, that's not acting. That's just reading the script. Acting is putting a bit of yourself into the words and putting emphasis on certain things or de-emphasizing others to make it yours or to carry a particular character
That's
forward.
true.
And I think
That's true.
song,
I'm the same friend.
yeah, sounds like that's what you do. Well, that's great. Listen,
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Well, what I want to say is also the same set of lyrics can be read in very different ways as well, right? So, like, you can also choose a different part of yourself to connect to, like, I don't know, an innocent part, a longing part, a teasing part, depending on what you feel the song is about.
Yeah, inflection can really change a lot of things in language.
Totally.
Yeah, well, that's
Totally.
great. Well, I want to go back, as I do with all my guests. I'm always interested in your origin story. So what I'm wanting to know
Yeah.
is who or what turned the light on for you? What turned you on to music and becoming a musician?
You want a full story?
You bet.
The full story. Okay, so I didn't necessarily set out to be a musician. When I was six, my parents, I actually lived in Baltimore. So I was born in Israel in a southern city in the Negev Desert. And when I was four, my parents and I moved to Baltimore, and we lived there for 4 years. Because they were both scientists, and they were doing their postdocs in Johns Hopkins. And they signed me up for piano lessons. My dad, his dream was to become a violinist. Because his parents were immigrants at the time, and they were like, "You're not going to make money off of that." He was basically his like road to like professional, being a professional musician was kind of stopped, and he became a, which is why he became a scientist. But he always it was always around. Like he's a very talented guy. He like would play piano in the house all the time, stuff like that, teach himself songs, instruments. And when I was six, they were like, "Okay, it's time for you to go study piano." And I did. And I, you know, we went back to Israel. I kept doing piano, and I studied classical piano for about 10 years. And I honestly didn't love it. I think mostly because where I was living, there weren't many people around me that were into music. So I was like, you know, and when you get better, you kind of have to practice to maintain, you know, and nobody was practicing hours a day. So I really wanted to stop. And when I was 16, I finally like managed to tell my parents to that I wanted to put an end to it. And but I was still like, you know, interested in music and acting, so I started like taking drama classes and singing classes. And it wasn't until my senior year of high school where I had an opportunity to study with a really famous vocalist from Israel. Her name is Riki Gal, who like was one of my dad's like favorite singers, and I had grown up listening to. I got like money from my grandparents. They had like a gift, and I said, "Oh, I'm going to use it towards singing lessons." And I would take the bus to Tel Aviv to study with this, you know, amazing vocalist and great teacher. And I kind of realized that I could sing, because I didn't really I liked singing, but I couldn't really. I needed like somebody to help me. Some singers are like very natural, and like I have students now that come to me and they're like can do anything. I could not sing. Like I needed guidance. And it so happened that I had friends in school that were into jazz, and there was a conservatory near me. One of the guys was having a like recital, and he said, "Why don't you come sing a song?" I want you to sing Summertime. I was like, okay. And I like was literally the first time I even heard, probably Ella. This is like 18. This is kind of late. The first time I heard Ella Fitzgerald was like when I was 18. And I studied the song and I sang it and stuff, one thing led to another, and I found myself like in a very strange band that had piano, guitar, flute, and myself. And the pianist kind of gave me like this DVD of at the time was like 4 gigs of vocal jazz, and he was like, you should be singing this music, listen to it. And there was like a bunch of Ceron and Ella, some Brazilian music too. And he was like, let's choose like 12 songs and let's start gigging. Let's just do a set, and we started gigging in my hometown, which I don't think anybody was playing jazz there at the time. And people like we I really got amazing like responses. And I said, and I was like, oh my God, maybe I can actually do this. I had no idea. Like, this was very surprising, but also very fun to finally be on stage singing like I wanted to. But then I went to the army because in Israel it's a mandatory service.
Compulsory, yep.
Yeah, so I didn't stop completely, but I was in a unit that was very demanding and my service was very involved, so I didn't have the time that I wanted to develop it. I kind of took some lessons here and there to try to maintain something. But it was not like a major part of my life in those years. And basically when I was going to like get released, discharged from the army, I thought to myself, if I don't try this this route of being a singer, I'm never going to forgive myself. But I really it wasn't like I was this is my dream and I'm going to make it come true, or maybe I thought that in my head, but it wasn't. It wasn't very, clear. It was just like, let's just try this. And so I started like looking at the very few programs that we had in Israel all the time for jazz, and I ended up somehow getting accepted to a program that is partnered with the New School. It's called it's like part of the Tel Aviv Conservatory. And they have this program that is combined with the New School. So you basically start your studies in Israel. You do 2 years of like the Chorus studies. And then the New School, they'll audition the Israelis for like a scholarship to come to New York and complete the degree at the New School, which is an amazing thing for us because A, like most of us can't pay like American tuition because our parents still won't save up for it. And also it gives you a visa. So just basically like, hey, you can come to New York, take classes, get a degree, but also be in the Greenwich Village, like. So it was amazing. But again, I got accepted. I was like, I'm probably not gonna go to New York. I'm just gonna try this out and see where it leads. And I fell in love like with jazz completely. I had some teachers that just introduced me to amazing music, and I honestly practiced and I worked my ass off because I had so much to catch up with. I was surrounded by people who had been doing this since middle school and were gigging, and here I was kind of like, I think I can sing, but I don't really know anything about this music. So I studied hard to try to get to where my peers were. And it ended up somehow working out, and I ended up like being able to go to the New School and finishing my degree here, and I stayed ever since.
That's awesome.
But for me, right, it, yeah, and it, what I want to say is that it wasn't like like this light that went on and I was like, oh my God, I have to do this forever. It was kind of like this ongoing process where I kept being like, I don't know if this is what I'm going to be doing, but I like it. So, it was a very cautious, like, let's see where the next step is going to take me and hope that it's going to work out. Now I can tell you, this is my dream and I'm living it. And but I was so scared to even admit it at the time, knowing that the chance not succeeding were like huge. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm so grateful. Like I look back now and I'm like, wow, I don't even know how I did that. And it was with a lot of help with from a lot of like, loving good people and
Sure.
educators and friends and family. But also, yeah, I guess I yeah, here I am.
Well, it just sounds to me like the flame of your passion just continued to get hotter and hotter until you started really
Yeah.
working more and more. And like you say, trying to catch up with others. That's because you had a real passion for it and ready to
Totally.
go. But I'm impressed with the number of musicians I have interviewed over the past 182 episodes, who are from
Nice.
Israel. And I'm thinking, man,
Yeah.
that school in Israel must really be doing something right because there are a number of marvelous musicians from Israel that I've had the opportunity to meet through my podcast. I'm
So
really
many.
impressed by that. Yeah, that's great. Well, then,
Yeah.
overall, your career in music, what would you say is one of the most memorable moments for you?
Yeah, I thought about that one. There's so many.
Well, I mean, you've already done some things that would be like my life's dream. I mean, you've performed at Birdland. I mean, you've done stuff
Yeah.
like that, but
That one's definitely up there.
you
I
know.
think the most memorable one was a show I did in Russia.
Oh, okay.
I think in 2017. I just have never encountered an audience so loving. I felt like the most amazing, important person in the world. Like I was singing and to like people were like so happy to hear the music. It was a festival, and it was in Rostov, so it wasn't like I think unlike I'm assuming I haven't been, but like it was like Moscow or St. Petersburg, so I think people didn't have as much opportunity to hear jazz as in the bigger cities, and they were just so amazingly loving. While I was singing, people were bringing up like bouquets to the stage, and I was
Oh,
like between
wow.
songs, like a kid came up and asked for my autograph, and
Yeah.
people wanted like to take selfies and like tell me their stories, and I was just so blown away, and I felt like it really felt like that audience was so wanting to receive what I wanted to tell them, and it just felt amazing because I saw like how this music influences them, and how positive and beautiful that is. So it was amazing, and I'm just like I'm dying to maybe one day when the world is a better place to like be able to go back. I was actually going to go back to like I had like a dates in Moscow, and then a whole war broke
Oh,
out,
yeah,
and
yeah.
now I just keep thinking of all those people who like don't get music that they deserve, among so many other things, Yeah.
I hear you. I hear you. Have you been to Japan yet?
I haven't. I know, but I
Okay.
hear that it's similar similar
Now,
experiences too.
I went to Japan. I went to Japan back in 1995 on a cultural exchange tour. And I'm just average Joe, I mean, I'm not a great professional musician. I'm an educator. I play, but oh my goodness, the Japanese treated us like royalty. It was
Yeah,
just
I heard it's
awesome. Yeah, you've
amazing.
got to go to
That's
Japan.
amazing.
You'd love and they
I
love
might
jazz.
one day. I
Yeah.
wish.
Yeah, there you go. You mentioned that you have students. What do you tell people aspiring toward a performing career in music?
I think perseverance.
Okay.
I don't I tell everybody, I'm like, you want to succeed in New York? Well, first of all, define success, because maybe like that's the first step. Of like what you want. But once you do that, the city is so full of opportunity that I really think that anybody who has the it's more of an emotional strength, honestly, than anything else, to like continuously get up in the morning, choose to do this. Choose to work on their craft, choose to like put themselves out there, create opportunities, will be able to like, flourish. I just think that a lot of times people break they like it, like the competition becomes too much, the rejection becomes too much, and they fall into like this, place where they're not meeting their full potential because of a lot of times because of emotional things.
Sure.
So that's the one thing that I always say. I'm like, if you can like acknowledge your pain, feel that it's hard, but then get up in the morning and take a deep breath and despite it, do it. That's one thing that I really, really try to preach to people. Another thing is people need to like go hear music. Like a lot of times I find myself telling students, I'm like, you are in the most amazing city in the world. There are so many crazy artists that are doing what you want to do. I have so many gigs that I could get you in for free. I know so many people I can like help you go see things. Go see things. It doesn't matter that you have to wake up at 8 a.m. tomorrow. It doesn't matter. Sleep 5 hours, sleep 3 hours, go do it. Like that's something that also I feel like sometimes people need to be like, hello, like look where you are. This is crazy. Go. Like that's how I think that's what brought me to where I am now. I was just like, I am in New York. Like this is amazing. I'm walking distance of the most amazing music that I like things that I hear on recordings and I could see it. So there's that too. I also tell them a lot about I think there's so much value in going, especially for like my vocalists, to go listen to other singers. Of course, singers that you that are older and you aspire to be like one day, but also peers. There's so much to be said about community support of other people's gigs. For whatever reason, a lot of people like don't do that as much, maybe because I don't know, they feel I don't know why. But I always made it a point, I try still, even though it's harder these days because I have a lot going on, but to like go see other vocalists' shows. You can learn so first of all, you're supporting a person who's a peer and is going through what you're going through, which is great. You're also like you're supporting the gig itself. Like it's important. Like the venues need you there, whatever it's a restaurant gig and you go and you get like dinner. Like that's important for continuing this amazing thing that we call live music that is we don't have enough of, and also it's really important, like, 'cause I learned so much by seeing other vocalists, how they like lead their band, what their choices are. You can see what you love and what you want to do, or what you decide that you don't want to do. Like you can learn. I really think that there's so much to be learned by supporting and seeing your peers as work. In addition to, of course, going out and seeing the greats that we
Sure.
have so much of here in New York, which is cool. So those would be the things that I can't stop saying
No, I agree.
to
I think,
people.
yeah, I mean, I think you can sum it up like what Yogi Berra, the great baseball catcher, once said. He was a catcher for the Yankees. He used to say, if you don't go to other people's funerals, they won't come to yours. And,
They won't.
but
That's
the thing of
true.
it is, you're right. We have to support each other in the arts world.
Totally.
And convince
Totally.
a lot of non-music or non-artistic people to do the same, because you're right. The venues will die. I mean, I think about clubs that have closed in New York. I think about clubs that have closed here in Milwaukee. We had used to have a wonderful place called the Jazz Estate, and it finally decided not to have live music anymore. And I hate to
Yeah,
see it, but that's one less place to play. Well,
I mean,
Eddie,
yeah, it's crazy. I mean,
yeah.
it's such a hard business. I don't know how these jazz club owners do it. They do
Yeah.
like they do it
Well,
though, and I'm like, let's support them, right? We want, we need,
I
we
think
both, we
you're
all need
right.
it. Yeah.
I think that's a good thing. Well, I know we're starting to get a little tight on time, but I do want to ask you. I got your newsletter today, in
Yay.
email, and please tell us about your upcoming live shows.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So this month I have two shows at Birdland, which is great. Always great to sing at Birdland. One of them is going to be on April 23rd, and it's a set of spring songs because it's spring,
Spring.
and some of the best music is happens in spring. I really like to do
Although spring can hang really hang you up the most,
it really can, and honestly,
yeah.
those are the best ones are like the ones that are ironically about spring, even though it's about sadness. And the other one, the one on April 30th, would be the Wild Is Love show, which we're doing to celebrate the music of the album. I also sing at Mesro every month, and this month it's going to be on April 14th. Mesro, which is, I don't know if you know, it's like the sister club of Smalls. It's a really nice, intimate venue. And what we do on Sundays is we would do like one set, and then the later set opens up into like this nice jam session, and it's very vocal friendly. Just a nice, like, chill, cool jam session that I lead, speaking of community and stuff. So I always like to invite people there, even if they're not musicians. It's just really interesting to see so much talent in one room, you know. So those are the shows. And then I'll be in San Francisco in May, and Black Cat, which is a cool club as well. And yeah, that's those are the highlights.
You know, I noticed in your newsletter you talked about singing at a jazz club in Nashville. And
I did.
I've interviewed a number of musicians based in Nashville, and you know,
Cool.
it's one of the things I'm kind of on a crusade to do is to break the stereotype that Nashville is only about two kinds of music, country and Western. And there's a very diverse music scene in Nashville, and they have a jazz club there. Now I didn't know that until I read your newsletter.
Yes.
That's
It's
good.
such a great jazz club. Yes, it's called Rudy's. And yeah, speaking of audiences, I mean, it was packed both sets, and I met so many people who were so in love with like jazz and the music, and the musicians were like amazing. I played with local cats there, and yeah, I wasn't expecting not a not good experience, but I was like blown away by how great it was and how much love and care there is for this music.
Well, I think what the general impression I have, the studio players in Nashville are very well versed in lots of styles.
Yes.
And I interviewed a singer who was based in Nashville who does a lot of genre hopping. I mean, I don't think there's a single country song on her new recording, but there's a lot of soul, R&B, jazz, you know, all these
Cool.
kinds of things. So it's really, really great. And I've even interviewed a Celtic folk musician who's based in Nashville. So it's nice to know there's a lot of diversity there, as is there in New York City. And actually, well, Milwaukee is a very d musically diverse town. And
I've never been.
well, there are some nice rooms. You can put this on your list, a place called Bar Centro. I know I was going to go see, I don't know if you know Nicole Xerates or
Of
not. Of
course.
course you do. She
I
was
love
on
her. She's a
my
great friend.
show. Oh yeah, she was on my show about a little over a year ago, and she was booked to perform at this place in Milwaukee called Bar Centro, but they had to cancel because it conflicted with our local music festival, which is the largest outdoor music festival in the world. It's called Summerfest, that's here in Milwaukee. And but their Bar Centro is booking people. I mean, it's one of the few. I can't get in there because my groups, they usually just book trios and quartets,
Oh, I see.
and my
Smaller.
modern jazz group is an eight piece. So you know, but
Oh, I'll check it out. Maybe I'll come
yeah.
visit
Oh, I'd love you if you'd come to Milwaukee. I mean, that'd save me airfare
Totally. You
to New
not
York.
to say that you shouldn't come to New York,
No, I
but
want to come to New
yeah.
York because I
I
haven't
know.
been there. The last time I was in New York was 1976. And the last
Oh,
time I, oh yeah, and the last
you must
jazz,
come back.
and the last jazz club I was in New York City was Buddy's Place, Buddy Rich's
Wow.
club. And I saw him and his big band at Buddy's Place, which of course I don't think exists anymore. But yeah, I
Yeah,
definitely want to
I
come.
know.
Yeah, so
Yes.
anyway, we'll have to do that. So I'll get in touch with
Yes.
you if my wife and I happen
Yes.
to make our way to New
Please
York.
do. Yes,
Well,
please do.
Nama, I try to be very thorough, but I know I'm not
Yeah.
perfect. So is there anything else you'd like to add or tell my audience I haven't asked you about?
I don't think so. Just
Okay.
I'm glad but yeah, thanks for giving me the
Okay.
opportunity to talk, speak my
Oh no, that's quite all
mind.
right. And I want to let my listeners know the new album will be available. I thought I saw in your newsletter it will be available on Bandcamp, but you also have
Yes,
physical copies
I
for that can
do.
be pre-ordered. And can they pre-order that
Yes.
through your website?
Once I get my stuff together,
Well, yeah.
in the next few days, yes, it will
Yeah.
be on that. They can also order through Bandcamp or my
Oh,
website.
through
Yes.
Bandcamp or through
Or
your
my
website.
website.
Okay.
Everywhere they find me, they'll find
Sure, sure.
a thing to click
I mean,
for the CDs.
we're still a couple 3 months out from official release, but at least
But
want
no, but
people to
I've
be
been,
thinking about it.
yeah, totally. And I've been mailing out CDs already. I don't like to me, it doesn't matter. I have the CDs. I want people to listen to it. So if they want a physical copy, they can already get it.
Okay, awesome. Awesome to know. That's just
If
great.
you want one too, I'll mail you one.
Well, I'll that'd be
Yeah.
wonderful. I'd love it.
If you
I'd
have
love
something
it.
to do with that, yeah. Great.
Yeah.
I'll can t give me your address afterwards and I'll
Okay.
put one in the
All
mail
right.
for you.
Sure enough, that'd be awesome. Thank you so much.
Of
Thank you.
course.
And I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today. I know you're a busy person so I really means a lot to me that you would take time to talk with me today and give my
To
best
me
to
too.
Dave
I will.
and I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you so much, Greg, and thanks. It's been an honor to be on this show. So hopefully I'll see you soon in New York. Yes.
Oh, you bet. You take care now.
Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My discovery composer of the week is Giovanni Lagrenzi. Baptized in 1626 near Bergamo, he died in Venice in 1690. Lagrenzi was one of the most gifted and influential composers of the latter half of the 17th century. Active in most fields of composition, he was an important force in the development of the late Baroque style in northern Italy. Lagrenzi was a son of Giovanni Maria Lagrenzi, violinist at the parish church in Clusone, and a minor composer. On July 30th of 1645, Lagrenzi became organist at San Maria Maggiore, Bergamo, and was elected a resident chaplain there in 1651. In 1653, he sought and was granted the title of first organist. He left this post in 1655. His published output from this period consists primarily of church music. In 1656, he became Maestro di Cappella of the Accademia dello Spirito Santo at Ferrara. His first opera, Nino il Giusto, dates from 1662. Ferrara also provided him with indispensable aristocratic connections, which he cultivated assiduously. Except for three operas, one oratorio, and several sonata di camera and dances, Lagrenzi's output during these years continued to be devoted to church music. He appears to have left Ferrara in June of 1665 after the completion of his third opera, Zenobia et Radamisto. With his departure begins a period of almost 5 years in which there is no certain information on his positions, except for those he sought unsuccessfully or refused. During these years, he published only church music. A letter of July 17, 1665, shows that Lagrenzi had enlisted the help of Carlo II Gonzaga, Duke of Mantua, in a bold scheme to obtain the post of Kapellmeister at the Habsburg court in Vienna. Lagrenzi is next found in 1669 competing for the post of Maestro di Cappella of the Milan Cathedral. In August of 1670, he enlisted the aid of Cardinal Girolamo Buonvisi, a patron from his Ferrarese days, in obtaining a similar post with the Duke of Parma. These years also saw the staging in Venice of two of his operas. By 1670, at the latest, Lagrenzi was living in Venice, where he began to hold posts at numerous religious institutions, always, it seems, with an eye on attaining a position in one of the major churches in northern Italy. On April 30th of 1676, Lagrenzi made his first attempt at becoming Maestro di Cappella of San Marco as successor to Cavalli. Upon his appointment at San Marco, there was a marked increase in the number of singers and instrumentalists hired. In fact, during Lagrenzi's years at San Marco, both the cappella and the concerto attained their largest recorded size. Lagrenzi's years as vice maestro were his last and most prolific in the field of opera, two appearing in Venice each year between 1681 and 1684. As maestro, he turned again to the composition of sacred music, writing responsories for Holy Week, a collection of motets, opus 15, and a mass dedicated to the Madonna of Loreto, but none of the music he composed for the San Marco Cappella seems to have survived. In his last years, his house where he lived with his sister was a center of musical life. From 1687, he was also the moving force behind the foundation of the Mutual Aid Society of Musicians in Venice. After 1687, his activities at San Marco were curtailed by an illness that was to prove fatal. He was buried in Santa Maria delle Fave. Lagrenzi's rise to fame, honor, and wealth was remarkable. As a young man from the provinces, his resources were so meager that he required a title of patrimony granted in 1649 in order to be ordained. But by 1653, he was able to underwrite the costs of educating three boys at the Accademia Mariano at Bergamo. At his death, he owned property in Clusone. The All Music Guide lists recordings of 61 of Lagrenzi's chamber works, 20 recordings of his choral works, 5 recordings of his operas, and 15 recordings of his vocal works. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video of a performance of Lagrenzi's Sonata Prima for Four Violoni, Opus 10, Number 13, performed by Clematis. That wraps episode number 185. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I'll be interviewing San Francisco-based blues harp player and singer, Big Harp George. We will be talking about his new album, Cooking with Gas, to be released on May 15th. Other upcoming interviews include Corey Adams from the Americana folk band Moonsville Collective, New York-based jazz singer, composer, and educator Aubrey Johnson, and pop Americana artist Camden West. So don't touch that dial. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurst@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.